today is the last conference, decolonizing Western universities, from Professor Ramon Grosso-Well. We'll have the lecture, and then we can decide if we can have a break and then the discussion, or if we have the discussion right after the lecture.
Okay. Thank you. This will be my last lecture here, but I have two more lectures here in Berlin. One on Sunday in the Marx conference. There's a conference here, 3-day conference on Marx. And I was invited to talk about that on Sunday. And then this Monday is in the, what's the name of that center?
Latin American Institute. The Free University.
Yeah, I'm going to also speak there, so I'll be a few more days around. For those of you interested in having a coffee or talking or whatever. So I'm going to finish today with the part that I announced the first day, which is the epistemological part. Usually the way I organize this kind of seminars, I usually start from what I'm going to present today. And then from there I move on into the other things you already heard. This time, I did it the other way around. So, I'm going to discuss today the epistemological foundation of Western thought. And I'm going to discuss in more detail the question about the universalism that is being used in most of Western philosophy, as well as Western thinking about universalism. So I'm going to focus on that. To do that, I'm going to discuss first four Western philosophers, and then I'm going to move on and discuss alternative ways of thinking about universalism, but now shifting the geography of reason and looking at how universalism has been thought in by other thinkers from the South. And I'm proposing this just because I think there is a trap in Western universalism from which Western thinkers in general cannot escape. There are kind of trap in that. And that has to do with the way universalism has been defined and constructed in Western male philosophy. And so I'm going to move into third world thinkers to see other ways of thinking about the same thing. The reason I'm looking for these other alternatives is because I think, as I will be discussing here, that Western universalism is in terminal crisis. That is just not producing anything good for the world. It's just producing global imperial nightmares from the left and from the right. And that's why I think that it's important to decolonize the concept of universalism in the West because of the problem that it has carried on from the right and from the left. The problem with these discussions is that they are beyond right and left because it's both sides. Westernized left, westernized right wing, they share a lot of the premises. And so that's why I'm going to, I think about overcoming it. So let's start with René Descartes. René Descartes is considered the foundation of Western philosophy. And you're going to see why I'm starting with Descartes as we go along. You might say, well, why is this guy starting with Descartes? Well, there are things about Descartes that, unfortunately, are still here with us. And these are the things, there are other things that are not with us, that even within Western tradition have been criticized. But there are all things that have been continued to be there until today. Even critical thinkers of Descartes in the West reproduce a lot of Cartesian legacy. You know, so this is what I want to identify. One of them is the concept of universalism. One aspect of that concept that we're going to discuss. So, first of all, let's say the famous slogan of René Descartes. René Descartes said, "I think, therefore I exist." That was a major foundational moment in in the West about shifting the authority of knowledge from the theopolitics of knowledge to something new that I'm going to be calling departing from the card, I mean beginning with the card, as the ego politics of knowledge. So the theopolitics of knowledge, I refer to the authority of knowledge in 1640, all the way from 16th century, all the way, you know, the authority of knowledge was the church. That was anything you say about anything, even science, that's the authority of knowledge. You know, you have to be approved by the church. Otherwise, you remember about the Inquisition. The Inquisition was there to make sure that knowledge was not going to be questioning the major dogmas of the church. So, in European history, the church was an obstacle for development of critical thinking, science, all kind of things. I'm saying European history, because that's not the case with other civilizations at the time. At the time, for example, Islam never had a problem between scientific development and spirituality. They never had a contradiction. That's why at the time, in Islamic civilization, you have all these advances in science. There was no problem with that. In the Maya civilization, for example, in Central America, no, it was also, and south of Mexico, no, all that area was Maya civilization. They have no problem between science and, you know, their cosmology, you know, the way they thought about spirituality and things. There was no contradiction, no dualism between one and the other. And therefore, there was no problem in developing scientific endeavors. For example, the Mayas, I don't know how much you are aware, that had the most precise calendar in the world, okay, in 1492. Okay, up to 1492, they have the most precise calendar. And still, you know, everybody that looks at it is amazed after 500 years later, because they're able to predict a lot of things, you know, like eclipses, lunar eclipses, solar eclipses, all kind of things, you know. And so, just to give an example, in the Islamic civilization, they have a lot of developments. As I said yesterday, 800 years before Europe, they already knew in the school of Baghdad that the center of the world was not the earth. Okay, that the earth was going around, it was not the center. So they have discovered all of this 800 years before. Things like medicine, things like Greek philosophy, for example, we discussed that yesterday. All kind of things that were developed. While in Europe, they would burn you alive if you were reading Aristotle. Okay, in the Islamic world, Aristotle was a major source of philosophical thinking. You know, so that's how the Greeks arrived to Europe. It was through Islamic civilization that controlled most of the south of Europe. And so they have all these, what we call Al-Andalus, that was Spanish, Islamic Spain, no? That was destroyed also in 1492. It's interesting that these things go together. But the point is that up till that point, the authority was in the hands of the church. If you produce a knowledge that was questioning the dogmas, you risk your life. And that happened to scientists at the time, all the way till, you know, even knowledges that were indigenous to Europe, that were carried on by women in Europe, were also knowledges that were destroyed. But they were destroyed by destroying the people. So there were millions of women burned alive in the 16th century. This is something that people disconnect, because while they were colonizing the Americas and wiping out indigenous people in America, they were also wiping out women here, because women here were carrying knowledges that were not official knowledges, or were knowledges that represented a threat to the dogmas of the church. The same thing happened with scientists in Europe. They have to do everything in hiding, because they will be burned alive, you know. Look at Galileo, you know, 17th century, etc. You could see all kinds of things happening So the history of that local history of Europe, there is a tendency to universalize it and to think that every religion is like that. And so we take the position that if this is the case in Europe, it must be the same everywhere. But that's not true. That's not true. That's absolutely false. In many parts of the world, in the majority of parts of the world, there was no contradiction between the spiritual belief and development of science and critical thinking. They have a different notion of looking at these things, where concepts of unity, like I was discussing the other day, Pachamama or Tawhid in Islam, or other concepts that put things in a more holistic way, allow for looking at scientific knowledge in a way that was not seen in contradiction with religious beliefs. Okay? If you want to use the term religion, because really that's a very Western-centric term. Nobody calls themselves religion elsewhere. You know, we have used the term religion to classify the world, but, you know, Buddhist, this and that. But in fact, this is the people in those places don't call it religious. That's a very recent term that has been used. Nothing to do with what they were really doing, but that's another discussion. So the point is that here comes Descartes, and he puts a new foundation of knowledge in 1640s. In the 1640s, he says, "I think, therefore I exist." That seems now from, you know, 21st century, like something simple, at the time was quite revolutionary in Europe, not outside Europe, inside Europe. Outside Europe, it was like, but you know, this is nothing new. I mean, what are you saying? You know, it was. But here in Europe, it was revolutionary because the church had the authority of knowledge. There was no way anybody can say, "I think, therefore I exist," and put as the foundation of knowledge this abstract I. This I, he never defined it. He never said, "Who is this I?" So this I is, let's put it a question mark here. Who is this I? He never answered it. Okay, he never said, "Who is this I?" But it's important to know that this move inside Europe, he was himself afraid. There are people doing research about his biography. He was afraid about this with the church. That's why he had kind of bringing back God somewhere, you know, so that he won't be accused of, you know, blasphemy or anything like that and be burned alive, you know. So the point is he but still this putting this there was already quite revolutionary for Europe at the time. And so the point of Descartes is, he would say that then the aim of knowledge is to produce knowledge that is universal, in the sense of producing a knowledge that is beyond time and space, that is truthful, okay, that is managed to know the laws of the universe, you know, of nature, etc. So he puts there a very comprehensive program where he said, "This eye can produce a knowledge from a God eye view." This is the phrase he will use. We can produce a knowledge from a God eye view. Meaning by that, a knowledge that is beyond any particularity. That you can produce a knowledge that is truthful for all time and spaces, and therefore you're not bounded by anything, okay, to limit your knowledge. That means this eye is able to produce a knowledge from a God eye view. It's like, so he takes the attributes of God, of the Christian God of the time, and he secularizes them in this eye. So all the attributes, God is the only one that can produce a knowledge beyond time and space. God is the one that has a, you know, it's floating somewhere and see the knowledge of all knowledges, absolute knowledge. God is the one, all these attributes, he will secularize them in this eye. Now it's not God who has these attributes. Now it's this eye that is able to imitate God and to produce a God eye view kind of knowledge. Okay? Now, how is it possible? The first question, how can he argue that someone can produce a God eye view, like a human being that is supposed to be finite and supposed to be limited, can produce a knowledge that is equivalent to the knowledge that God has? How is that possible? So he has two things that are fundamental, that are constitutive of Cartesianism. The first one is dualism. He needs to have a dualism between of substances, between the body and the mind. He will say that the mind is of a substance that is completely different from the body. That means it's regulated by laws that are not the same as the laws of the body. And he will make this split between mind and body. So this decapitation of the head from the body is a fundamental constitutive process in Descartes to be able to make the argument of a Godine view in knowledge production. Why? What will happen if the head is placed in your body? What will happen if your head is not decapitated, it's just inside your body and is regulated by the rules that regulates your body? That means that then you are bounded by a body and by time and space. That is, that means that then you, if you're bounded by a body, if you're producing knowledge from a body and your body is located in time and space, then it's absolutely impossible that you can pretend to produce a knowledge beyond time and space like God. It's impossible. So the only way he can get to make the argument is to have this idea of the dualism. That's the only way. Otherwise, then the body, the mind will be located like the body in space and time. And if that's the case, then you cannot claim a God-eye view of the world. So he wanted to keep the mind floating somewhere, you know, like an ethereal substance, from where that is undetermined by time, space, you know, by location in any space. And this is why I call it the ego politics of knowledge, because this is a knowledge that is an I, that is in a sense insulated from any determination outside itself. So the second thing he needs is the solipsism. Solipsism is this internal dialogue of the subject with himself, okay? Where you ask questions is the method of the doubt. You know, you're going to doubt every statement until finally you get to a statement where you feel that you have achieved a certitude of knowledge, okay? A solid, you know, stone-like certitude of knowledge, where you cannot doubt anymore. So that is achievable, he said, through an internal dialogue of the subject with himself, through the method of the doubt. So he has to claim that knowledge is produced in a monologue. In a monologue of the subject with himself. That way he disconnects the subject and the mind from social relations. What will happen if knowledge is produced in dialogic ways? That is, in interaction with other human beings, in dialogue with other human beings. Then the argument that you produce a God-like view will fail. Because then if you happen to produce knowledge in relation with other human beings, okay, then that means that you are situated in time and space. And if you're situated in time and space, then it's impossible you have a God-like view. Okay, so he needs this, the method of the solipsism and the dualism, to construct the ontology of the individual subject of modernity. Okay, where you, the individual subject is an ontology where individuals happen to be kind of insulated unit, atomistic units, okay, that are undetermined by anything, you know, and that's the only way he can make the claim. Without that, it will be very difficult for him to make that claim. Without dualism and without solipsism. Without dualism, then he will have to concede to the point that the mind is in a body and the body is in time and space and there's no way out of it. Okay, you cannot produce any more of the correct view. And without solipsism, he will have to acknowledge that knowledge is produced in social relations. And that way you're not an insulated entity in dialogue with yourself producing knowledge, but you are determined and affected by other human beings. And if that's the case, then you are also located in some time and space in a particular position where you cannot just have your mind floating around the earth, you know, like God, you know, and looking at from a God eye view at everything. This is impossible to achieve. So here comes this is what Colombian philosopher Santiago Castro Gomez calls the philosophy of point zero. Okay, this ego polis of knowledge is a philosophy of point zero, because it's like the point zero, meaning by that you know, is a point of view that do not assume itself as a point of view. It's a point zero. It's a point, the beginning or a foundation for knowledge that is not in itself a point of view. You know, so he called it, this is a point of view that do not assume itself as a point of view, that assume itself as some God-like view, you know, of the world that is not determined by any point of view. So in that sense, the notion of objectivity that is produced in Cartesian philosophy, which is the notion that carries on into the Western scientific projects, is a notion of objectivity equivalent to neutrality. You see, because the God-eye view implies that you have the knowledge of all knowledge, that you're not determined by anything, and therefore your knowledge is able to produce objectivity in the sense of neutrality, because you're not bounded by any kind of determination, space, time, or social determination. You are somewhere, your mind's floating somewhere else that is not determined by the laws that affects the body. And therefore, that ethereal matter that is called the mind is able to then produce a knowledge that is undetermined by anything. Okay? That's the move he does to be able to make this claim. But look at the notion here of universalism, objectivity, etc. Where the notion here is a notion in which the God-eye view pretension is that you produce a knowledge that is unbiased, that is neutral, that is objective, that is universal in the sense that is valid for everybody in the world. Okay? And the point that Descartes the point here, there are that Dussel, Enrique Dussel, the philosophy of liberation in Latin America, will ask is, what are the political, historical, and economic conditions of possibility of someone in the mid-17th century like Descartes to have the arrogance to talk as if he is replacing God at the foundation of knowledge? What are the conditions of possibility of that? So he's trying to look at the history of the production of this subjectivity. Where is this subjectivity coming from? How come, if you look at all that, this is a moment in world history that is very unique and original, because for the first time in world history, if you look at all the traditions of thought, nobody claims to be thinking or replacing God, okay? Nobody. No tradition of thought, okay, elsewhere, pretend to be thinking like God or like gods in the places where there are many gods. You know, this pretension happened at a moment in history, and what then philosopher of liberation of Latin America asks is, what is this moment? What are the conditions of possibility of this? Who is this I? What is the social existence of this I? Okay. And the ego cogito, you know, this is in Latin, remember Descartes is writing in Latin at the time, and the I think, therefore I exist, is in Latin, is ego cogito. Okay. And so the answer that Enrique Dussel gives to this question is, if you examine carefully, Descartes is thinking in mid-17th century, he's in Amsterdam. Amsterdam is the new center of the European world economy that emerged in 1492 and that has displaced Spain and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula, as the center of the system. So there is a new center in northwestern Europe with Amsterdam as the new hegemonic power of this system after the 30-year war, you know, where, and then the signature of the Treaty of Westphalia, okay, Westphalia, where you have then the acknowledgement of rules of recognition of sovereignty among European empires, okay, that was never extended to the rest of the world, but it was extended among the European empires. There was a subalternization then and later inferiorization of Spain and Portugal in this system. So he's saying, well, this guy is thinking from the new center of the world system at the time of this European world economy, which is Amsterdam. And second, if you examine carefully, the ego cogito the condition possibility of the ego cogito is the ego conquerus, 150 years of the ego conquerus. I conquered, therefore I am. So you have at the foundation of this new subjectivity the imperial being. That is, the imperial being becoming the new the imperial being becoming the new this subjectivity that is now replacing God. Okay? So the imperial being, the I conquered, therefore I am, is the condition of possibility of I think, therefore I am. There's no ego cogito without ego conquerus. That is, what is the condition of possibility for someone in the mid-17th century to claim to be producing a knowledge from a God-eye view and replacing God as the new foundation of knowledge? Who is this I? Well, the answer of Dusser is this is an imperial I. This is the social existence of imperial being. And therefore, they are now, they don't need God. They are throwing away God and now putting themselves as God. Now, this has a lot of world historical consequences. Because even though internal to Europe, you have this struggle between the authority of knowledge, external to Europe, this claim that this eye can produce a God-eye view, that this eye can produce a knowledge beyond time and space, that this guy can produce universal knowledge, okay, that is not determined by anything, is a claim of superiority in knowledge production over the rest. Because what you're doing is secularizing the attributes of God into this eye. And this eye, being the imperial eye, will go around the world preaching its truth with capital T and inferiorizing all the other epistemologies of the world. So the Cartesian project, okay, despite its pretension of being a revolutionary project inside Europe, it became being produced inside the zone of being that I was discussing before in the other seminars. It became an imperial colonial design, okay, at the level of epistemology. Because now the West will go around the world colonizing people using the subjectivity of this imperial eye as the only one that is able to produce universal knowledge that is not determined by anything. And that knowledge is universal, it's not particularistic, and therefore is superior. Okay? The other knowledges, remember, for Descartes he needs the dualism to make the claim. He needs to split the mind from the body to be able to claim that knowledge, this eye, knowledge is beyond time and space, universal, etc., and have all the attributes of God, because that way he has no determination of being within time and space, because then the mind will be floating somewhere. Remember the solipsism. He needs the solipsism to detach the knowledge production, that is the monologue, the philosophy of death, that is a philosophy that you don't listen to others, you listen to yourself in an internal monologue. You need that to be able to then claim the possibility of that you don't produce knowledge in dialogue with other human beings, and therefore you're not determined by any particular circumstances. That's why then he's able to make the jump to say, we are now, I can produce a knowledge just like God produced knowledge. Okay? This move, the philosophy of death, filosofía de la sordera, is fundamental for the foundation of this form of universalism. Okay? And so then the problem, the question is now, what is exactly universalism here? Well, universalism here means is a knowledge that has pretension to be valid, okay, beyond time and space to everybody on the planet. This is the pretension. And it's supposed to be neutral, objective in the sense of neutrality. Here you have the narrative that constitutes Western epistemology about sciences. Because we're still going to carry this legacy until today about this, the pretension of, you know, knowledge that is supposed to be, you know, objective in the sense of neutrality, in the sense of not being determined by anything in particular, or any kind of time, space, or social circumstances. This mythology is going to continue until today. The question is now, what are the types of universalism that are implied in the car? I will talk about two types of universalisms. One is the universalism about the statements, what is being said, and the other one is the universalism of the locus of enunciation, that is, who is saying it. Okay? Now, if you examine carefully, in the car you have both, because the pretension is that the things that are the statement, what is being said, is supposed to be beyond time and space. It's supposed to be universal in this sense of a God eye view. But the subject who is able to produce that is this abstract I that he never defines. Okay, that is the locus of enunciation. That is, it's an ego police of knowledge. It's an I that is insulated from the world, insulated socially and insulated in terms of time and space, where the mind is undetermined by anything. And that's the way he can argue then that this subject is the only one able to produce a universal knowledge this way. Now, the question now is, if this universal knowledge is produced by all these claims that I've been describing, these two types of universalism, what I'm going to do now is looking at different philosophers and see how these two types of universalism evolve in Western, in the, let's put it this way, hegemonic, canonic Western philosophers. Now, before going there, the question is, who is this I? Finally, who is this I? Well, Dusa respond to that saying, is the imperial I. The pretension of producing a knowledge just like God is only coming from someone that has put itself at the center of the world and now is throwing away God as a source of authority and say, I am the authority. I am the one who defines what is truth and what is not truth. This epistemic privilege, okay, that Descartes is now claiming for this I is only possible if you are in a position of power to define, to say that, and to make the claim and make it a global design. You see, that's why he's saying, listen, the condition, historical condition of possibility, political and economic, is that now this is Amsterdam. He's thinking from Amsterdam, the new center of the world, and Descartes is becoming the philosopher of this new empire, who is now throwing away God and putting this new foundation in Western man. Because if you watch carefully at the time, even though he never defined with this I, at the time, if you do a sociology of knowledge production at the time, it was only women were not part of that, okay? Western women were not part of that because Western women were irrational beings, okay? So the rationality that Descartes is claiming do not apply to women. And the rationality he's claiming do not apply also to non-Western people, be that male or woman, okay? Because non-Western people at the time were considered to be inferior beings. So both women and non-Western people were considered to be inferior beings with no access to rational thought. And therefore, for Descartes, this I was very obvious for the car and for the people at the time reading the car. It was Western man. He's talking about Western man. But it doesn't become clear. He doesn't have to justify it, you see, in any statement, because it, at the time it was common sense for within the circles of knowledge production controlled by Western man, that he was Western man, the eye, this eye that is able to produce a godlike view. Okay, so from now on, you have the foundation of a tradition of thought that is sexist and racist at the same time, because it's excluding from the conversation everybody who is not Western, and it's excluding from the conversation all women, be that Western or non-Western, it doesn't matter. So it's a sexist, racist tradition of thought from the beginning. Okay? So in that, this is the foundational moment of this tradition of thought, that later on then we move into Kant, for example, and in Kant you see a dialogue with this kind of tradition where you have in Kant the transcendental subject. In the transcendental subject in Kant, you remember that for Kant the question was how was possible, what are the conditions of possibility for scientific knowledge, in this case physics, etc. See, this is the main question he posed. And the answer to that is he talks about the a priori categories that are, in a sense, that are shared in our mind, you know, by the transcendental subject. Okay, this is the way he solved the issue. He says, the way we can then agree intersubjectively about science is because we share. We always filter whatever empirical evidence within the world with these categories that are, in a sense, a priori, that are inserted in our minds. In this case, categories such as quantity, quality, categories as form and content, categories. He goes over a list of these categories that then he will claim that it's impossible to know the thing in itself, because human beings always filter whatever empirical evidence or whatever experience they have through these categories. So that's in the Critique of Pure Reason, where he develops this argument. And in the Critique of Pure Reason, he never says who is the transcendental subject. He takes it for granted, and he says, well, the transcendental subject is this subject that have all these a priori categories through which then empirical evidence is filtered, and therefore we never are able to know the thing in itself. Okay? He says we cannot know the thing in itself because we always filter the world with these categories that are, in a sense, categories that are a priori, that are in our minds, are not social categories, are not historical categories, are categories that we were born with them, in a sense. We are born with them. And so we go and do scientific work, and then whatever we evidence we find is filtered through these a priori categories. So, if you look now at the two types of universalism of Descartes, you could see that in the statement that you can never know the thing in itself, he's a critique to the universalism of the statements of what is being said. Because now he's putting some finite limits to human knowledge, because he's going to be saying, listen, we can never know the thing in itself. That, in that sense, we cannot produce a knowledge exactly like God, because the thing in itself, that's beyond our possibility, because we always filter the world through these other a priori categories, and we never can have a transparent access to the thing in itself. However, the universalism of the logos of enunciation, that is the rational, the possibility of having rationality and producing a knowledge that is universally valid and things like that. Who is able to produce that? Now Kant is going to ground and to say explicitly who is this I in the car, or who is this transcendental subject. In his anthropological writings, if you remember, most of his life Kant was teaching geography. He was not teaching philosophy, he was teaching geography. And you could see in his philosophy, in his anthropological writings, a lot of a complete articulation of who is this transcendental subject. Because then he will say, and that's what I said a few days ago, that reason will begin north of the Pirin Mountains. Pirin Mountains, if you remember, are the ones that are in the border between Spain and France. And so what happened is that now, with this statement, he will claim rationality only in northwestern Europe. Below northwestern Europe, Spain and Portugal will be expelled, are expelled in Kant from access to rationality. Okay? He will be very explicit about that. He will claim, it's interesting and at the same time paradoxical, because if you examine carefully, this European war economy and the European colonial expansion began with the Iberian Peninsula. It began with the Spaniards and the Portuguese. But then, a few centuries later, they will be subalternized within Europe once the center is displaced away from the Iberian Peninsula into northwestern Europe. And now there is not just displaced politically and economically in terms of power, but they're displaced epistemically. Because now the new epistemic center and the new epistemic privilege is going to be centered in northwestern Europe. And Kant is going to be a philosopher who will make it very explicit. Okay? He will make very explicit the argument about the how rationality is north of the Pirin Mountains. Now, if you examine carefully, in Kant, you have an explicit articulation of this, where now he's going to be explicitly talking about the different subjectivities using color racism. He will say yellow people, black people, and red people. Red people are indigenous people in the Americas, black people in Africa, and yellow people in Asia. They are not mature. They don't have access to rationality. They are inferior beings in that sense. So they are irrational. So the transcendental subject do not include people from Asia, Africa, or the Americas. Okay? The transcendental subject is only in the hands of European men. Okay? Women are also outside, okay, access to rationality. Women of Western, non-Western, it doesn't matter. Women are out. So it will be very explicit about it that, again, then the locus of enunciation of the universalism of the locus of enunciation, the epistemic privilege, is going to be a Western man. And he won't say Western man, he will say white man. He will use color in his writings, very explicitly. This tells you something about the continuities here. Even though he's questioning the universalism of the statements, he still carry on the legacy of Cartesianism the moment that he brings or continue to bring in the universalism of the locus of enunciation. Because he will, again, keep bringing, he continued with this ideal of Western man as the center of the epistemic privilege of the world. The only one that is able to produce science, the only one that is able to produce rational knowledge, and the only one who is able to be called part of what he called the transcendental subject. Okay? So these are important things. People will say, well, listen, I don't care about who was there. I care about Kant's philosophy. Well, I'm sorry, but there's no way to delink these things because, I think most of the people in this room won't be inside the eye of the car or the transcendental subject of Kant. Okay? So this implies it's very important because then we're talking about a tradition that is constituted as a tradition that is sexist, racist, and homophobic. It's all together, okay? Because we're talking about a Western man, heterosexual man, a Western heterosexual man, the foundation of knowledge, the only one to access to rationality, okay? So here you have narratives that are racist, sexist, and homophobic in the Western tradition of thought that are constitutive of that tradition of thought. Okay? And that implies that other type of knowledges, other types of traditions of thought, other types of sciences, other type of critical thinking from other epistemic tradition are inferiorized, are completely out of the conversation. Okay? This is why this is important, because there's no, it established from the beginning an authority knowledge that is already authoritarian, racist, sexist, etc. You know, so it's already establishing a hierarchy, an epistemic hierarchy that I spoke yesterday. Remember, it was one of the 14 hierarchies that is fundamental for the constitution of the system we live, or the civilization we live. And so, we move to Hegel. Hegel. We can go in more detail about Kant. I'm going very fast just for the sake of going over the lecture. But anyway, we move to Hegel. In Hegel, you have in his lessons for universal history, okay, where he's talking about the development of the spirit. What Hegel will do, he will historicize the a priori categories of Kant. What Kant conceived as a priori categories, Hegel will say these are, historically speaking, manifested over time. So it's the expression or manifestation of the spirit over time. And for him, the spirit is the civilization. Okay, the ideas, the civilizational ideas of the evolution of over time. And he will look at these categories in different historical moments becoming emerging over time, and then reconstructing this knowledge. And he will claim that, in a sense, for Hegel, he will say that the spirit began in the East, okay, among the yellow people. But it stayed in a very mature stage. So yellow people are like child. Okay? That's said also by Kant. Kant is saying the same thing, that yellow people are like child. They stay in a very infantile stage of humanity. Okay? So they stay like child. And therefore the spirit did not evolve over time. The spirit got stagnant there. Okay? The only place where it really evolved and culminated is in European civilization. The spirit never passed through Africa and never passed through the Americas. That means the red people and black people, the spirit went, never visited there, never went there. Okay, so the spirit went straight from the east to the west. Okay, that's Hegel. Okay, people over there in Africa and in these people are inferior beings, you know, that the spirit never passed through them. And so he would claim that the spirit had culminated in European civilization, that European civilization is the most advanced civilization, and therefore he's the one calling for end of history. He will say, this is the most advanced, we got to the climax, to the peak of human development, and from now on, all we're going to see is just repetition of the same, because we got to the top. And I am the philosophy of the end of history. So if we are at the end of history, history end here, because we got to the top, to the, you know, the most advanced, and nothing more advanced will come after, then I am the philosopher of the end of history. Now, guess what? If I'm the philosopher of the end of history, then I have the privilege of looking back in history and reconstructing a posteriori, not a priori, all knowledges, and develop the knowledge of all knowledges. Absolute knowledge. Fantastic, no? Absolute knowledge. Now I have absolute knowledge, you know, because I can now reconstruct the knowledge of all knowledge. Because now I am at the end of history, and now I can see the world, you know, all the knowledge of all the knowledges. And if I'm at the end of history and nothing new will come after me, then I have absolute knowledge. So I have a God-eye view. You see, because I am, it's like in the final judgment, no? It's very Christian, because you, some interpret it's a secularization of Christianity. It's the when you get at the end of history with the final judgment, no? When now God comes and is going to judge everybody, and you know. Well, here is Hegel replacing God and judging everybody, okay? And now it's final judgment. There's nothing new after me. So I know, you know, the knowledge upon knowledge, you see? And he replaces God once again. But the difference with Descartes, so in the universalism of the statement, he will repeat again, you know, the universalism of the statements, because his statements, he will claim to be, you know, valid beyond time and space, because now he's the philosopher of the end of history, he has the God-eye view, and he can see the knowledge of all knowledge and reconstruct it. You see, that's his claim. So he goes back to the universalism of the statements, but from a different angle from Descartes, because in Descartes, the universalism of the statement were immediate and were a priori. In Hegel, the universality of the statement is a posteriori, it's a historical reconstruction a posteriori, you see? And so it's a different method, but arriving to the same place, because it's still claiming that the statements are valid for all time and space. So again, the statements are universal in the Cartesian sense, but using a different methodology, okay? And a different argument. But again, I have the knowledge of all knowledge. I know absolute knowledge. This is the claim. That's why at the end, you could see that at the end of the Phenomenology of the Spirit, you could see that also in other writing where he talks about absolute knowledge. You know, and make a claim about absolute knowledge. But anyway, in the logic too. But anyway, so you could see there that in the universalism of the locus of enunciation, a continuity again, because now is Western man, again, the peak of civilization, judging the rest of the world, inferiorizing everybody else, and it's only Western man who has access, the epistemic privilege, and access to this universal God-like view of the world, okay? So, now I'm going to Marx. Marx is probably among all the Western philosophers the one that most radically questioned the universalism of the statements, because he will say that all knowledges are bounded to the articulation of modes of production and class struggle over time. That means that knowledge is always bounded in terms of a very finite moment. That is the ideas of an epoch, of an era, is the ideas of the dominant class. He will make that claim. He will say that in order to understand this, you need to look at the articulation of modes of production over time. You need to look at class struggle. You need to look who is the dominant class and things like this. And then, looking again in a very Eurocentric way about European history, he would say that humanity have gone from slavery to feudalism to capitalism, because he takes antiquity in European history, the Roman Empire, as the period of slavery. He takes Middle Ages as the period of feudalism, and then he takes the modern moment as the period of capitalism. So he sees this evolution of modes of production from slavery to feudalism to capitalism in a linear way. And then he thinks that that's the way everybody else should go. Okay? Because he was saying this is the way to European civilization. Here is where he continued the Hegelian and Kantian, and he would say European civilization is the most advanced. He would agree with that point. He would say that European civilization is superior to the rest. And therefore, what needs to be done is for humanity, other parts of the world that are stagnant in time. He read the Orientalists of his time. He was, in the sense of Said, very Orientalist. He thought of people in the non-West as people stagnant in time. with this despotic mode of production called despotic orientalism, where it's a mode of production that just reproduces itself and they're stagnant in time. These are primitive people. The only way to bring them to civilization, in his view, was through an imperial invasion of advanced capitalist societies. That's why he was in favor of British invasion of India in the 18th century, because he thought that was the best for India. The best thing that could happen to Indian people is to be invaded by a Western power that will bring them and lift them up to civilization. Because these people are way behind, they're primitive, they're stagnant in time, they are so they need to be pushed into civilization, into capitalism, and then you will have the possibility of the formation of the proletarian that then will move them into socialism. And the same argument he used in the invasion of the US to northern Mexico. Okay, the same argument. Invasion of US in northern Mexico in the mid 19th century, he would write in favor of it because he thought that this is the way to go, because these primitive people need to be get out of this stagnation and then push them in this evolution of modes of production like Europe did. You see, he even justifies slavery. He even justifies slavery, saying, "Well, that's a necessary moment to be able to push these people away from this primitive man, teaching them skills of labor, and then they will the evolution of modes of production will happen there, like in Europe." So it was very Eurocentric in that sense, very racist, very Orientalist. Sorry, something about no. If there's something about what I said that you want me to repeat, I can repeat because my accent might not be clear. But anyway, so he will repeat this, despite the fact that he questioned the. So he will say, listen, the access now to critical thinking. In his critique to political economy, it's not going to come anymore from the bourgeoisie, because the bourgeoisie, the European bourgeoisie, is defending the capitalist system. They cannot, all they can do is to cover up the way the system works. So bourgeois political economy is going to be unable to produce a scientific knowledge of this system, because they have more to hide than to recognize, because they have privilege to defend, and therefore they're not going to acknowledge certain things. So the privileged view for him was the European proletariat. He thought that from the point of view of the European proletariat, you are able then to do a radical critique to political economy and then be able to produce a scientific knowledge about that system. That is, be able to, and that's when he claims the discovery of surplus value as a scientific discovery, because it's the mechanism through which you have exploitation in the capitalist mode of production. Okay, so, and he will claim epistemic privilege, not now to the elites of Europe, not now to the imperial eye of Europe, but to the proletarians of Europe. Okay, now is the point of view of the European proletariat is going to give humanity, okay, the universal knowledge, truthful, universal, valid for all places. This is the chief of Marx. Okay, now if you examine carefully, this is a Eurocentrism from the left, because now what is going to happen is that you have, remember, zone of being. Who has been here? Who is here for the first time? Because we have gone over so many things that, I don't know, maybe there are things that you might be missing in the conversation, but this is one thing we have discussed over and over again over the last 3 days. Zone of non-being. And so the problem, again, for those who are not here, the dialectic by another, very fast in 3 sentences, dialectic by another applies here, because there is a recognition of the humanity of the people here. Okay. That means that all the conflicts, class, gender, sexual, political, economic, whatever conflicts happen here, they are regulated through mechanisms of civil rights, democratic rights, human rights, mechanisms of emancipation, etc. Okay? Which is very different from the conflict that happened in the zone of conflict. These are the people considered superior, these are the people considered inferior. This is the line of the human. Okay? People below the line of the human are subhuman, non-human. This is the racist hierarchy. Okay, so I'm talking here about race, okay? Some people ask me the first day, but you didn't talk about race. This is a racist hierarchy, okay? Because it's talking about superiority, inferiority along the line of the human. And so this would be marked through color, through ethnicity, through religion, through their different ways of marking superiority, inferiority. I explained that yesterday. Anyway, the point is that in the soul, the critical thinking produced from the other, in the zone of being, criticizing the imperial I, okay, is not the same as the critical thinking produced from the zone of non-being, okay, criticizing both the imperial I and the critical thinking of the other inside the zone of being. These are two different geopolitical locations, okay, of knowledge production. Okay, because what happened is, let's say Marx. Marx is a critical thinking thinker inside the zone of being against the imperial I. See? Against the capitalist system in this case, no? Or you have a feminist, Western feminist, doing a radical critique of the imperial I here. Okay? Or you have, you know, you have many critical thinkers, or the Frankfurt School, who were critical thinkers, you know, within the zone of being, criticizing this imperial eye. But the problem with this is that the knowledge produced, as critical as it is a knowledge produced from the zone of being. In the zone of non-being, the way to regulate conflict is through violence and appropriation. Okay, so you have perpetual war in the zone of non-being, and you have perpetual peace in the zone of being. And therefore, the experience that is lived here of oppression is going to be very different from the experience of oppression here. And therefore, the theories produced to account for the oppression of people inside the zone of being are not applicable to the understanding of the oppression lived in the zone of non-being. Is that clear? The theories produced in the critical theories produced of about or on the oppression of people in the zone of being are not going to be applicable to the conditions of the oppressions lived in the zone of non-being. So look at this. Marx is a critical thinker from within the zone of being. Okay? In relation to the zone of non-being, he's a reactionary. Because he believes everybody else is inferior, he supports the invasion of Europe to the rest, and even justified on the term that Europe is more civilized than everybody else. And he used all the narrative of the time. Okay? But the only thing is that he would say, I vindicate the European proletariat as the epistemic privilege of the system. You see? Here they would say, no, I vindicate the imperial elites, no, or the elites of Europe as the critical thinker or as the privileged epistemic space from which to produce knowledge, like the other philosophy we discussed. No? But that is nothing to do with the critical thinking produced from here. And the point is that the critical thinking produced from here, they know very well the critical thinking produced from here, and they know it for imperial colonial reasons, because it's being imposed everywhere. But these people do not know this critical thinking, because they don't know it. It's not accessible, it doesn't circulate, it's inferiorized, it's not even taken seriously, you know. So, people from here, or critical thinkers from here, the theories produced here do not work for them, for the struggle of liberation, for the struggle of understanding the situation where they're at. Okay? So, if you examine carefully, in terms of the universalism of the statements, Marx is going to question that, because he would set up in a more radical way than Hegel and the others the question about more radical way than Kant, because he will historicize it, but he will put it in relation to articulation modes of production and class struggles. Okay, the ideas of the time will always be in relation to class struggle. Now, in terms of the universalism of the locus of initiation, he will reproduce once again the problems of the European man defining for the rest. You see, one defining for the rest, because it's but replacing it with the European proletariat. That is a male also, but it's an oppressed subject inside Europe. That is going to now to produce a global design. That's why he always called for proletarians of the world unite. And he would call for socialism as a solution everywhere. Okay? It's a colonial, imperial, global design, but now from the left. Because once again, one defining what is good for you. Okay? In all these projects here, colonial, imperial design, the moment that they establish a systemic privilege, and then they build global design and say, I know what is best for you. Your knowledge is inferior to me. And because your knowledge is inferior to me, you're not unequal to me, and I know what is best for you. So if I have to kill you to save you from your soul, or save you from your primitiveness, or from your uncivilized behavior, well, I'll kill you, because I know what is better for you. This paternalism, this racism, is embedded in Western universal thought, okay, in the concept of universalism of the West. Because it's always Western man defining what is good for the rest. It's never a conversation as equals. It's never the question, what do you think is good for you? That question is never raised. Not even in Marx, which is supposed to be a critical thinker within this tradition. That question is not even raised. Not what I think is good for you. What is good for you? Tell me what you think is good for you. Let's have a conversation. Let's have a inter-epistemic dialogue as equals. Okay, let's come up with different ways of thinking about everything, about the world, etc. How do you think in your tradition about democracy? How do you think in your tradition about human rights? How do you think in your tradition about woman liberation? Because this happened not only in the right, but it happened in the left. It happened in feminism. It happened, you know, you could see this problem, colonial, imperial project. And this is the epistemic foundation. The epistemic foundation is just what I've been explaining here, which is a universalism which one defines for the rest. Okay? And one that positions itself as a God ideal or a God-like figure that knows what is better for you. And the rest are just inferior beings. That's what I've been calling this tradition epistemically sexist and racist at the same time. That's why I call it an epistemic racist, sexist tradition of thought, the Western man tradition of thought. Okay? Because it's always about Western men defining for the rest. I don't care if here is Hegel, okay, and here is the proletarian or Marx, if you're doing the same thing. I don't care if here is Kant or here is Foucault, if you're doing the same thing. As critical as this will be, as insightful this will be to understand something in this zone, the moment you use it as a universal global design, then you fall back into this epistemic sexism and racism. Because then you are reproducing the same imperial project of inferiorizing all the other epistemic traditions of thought that exist out there. Okay? We don't even listen to that. So, and then we preach democracy. Okay? And then democracy is always democracy defined by Western men. So I want to include you in my concept of democracy. But there's no question about, do you want to be included in this concept of democracy? What is your concept of democracy? And then let's have a conversation as equal. Okay, if your concept is this and mine is that, how can we
negotiate this. That's not the conversation. The conversation is, here's the concept of democracy. I want to be democratic, so I want you to be part of this. But I define the terms of the conversation. That's why the Zapatistas in Latin America say, as opposed to the French Revolution notion of equality, they say we're equal because we're different. In other words, the only way we can be equals and have an equal horizontal conversation is if you recognize my difference. And once you recognize my extended difference, then we can have a conversation as equal. But if I come with my epistemology and my view of the world, and come and tell you I want to make you equal to me, on my terms, that's inequality. I'm just imposing on you my views. And then the way this works is I impose it by persuasion, and if you are not convinced, then I use the force. Then I invade you, I kill you. So we went from Christianize or I kill you in the 16th century to civilize or I kill you in the 19th century to develop or I kill you in the 20th century to democratize or I kill you in the 21st century. All global colonial designs, okay, where we bring Christianity, civilization, development, and now democracy with the bullets. And the foundation of this is this epistemic racism, where we think we know what is better for you because we have superior knowledge. Our knowledge is not bounded by any particularism, see, because it's beyond any kind of determination. I'm thinking from nowhere. This is the ego politics of knowledge. So I'm thinking from nowhere, therefore I'm objective, I'm unbiased, I'm neutral. But you are thinking from Islamic tradition, you are thinking from Buddhist tradition, you are thinking because the Western male tradition though, is the only one that has the hypocrisy to claim to produce a knowledge that is God-like and that is not determined by any particularism. This is the universal Islamic man. If you watch the other traditions, everybody will tell you, well, I'm an Islamic philosopher, or I'm a Buddhist philosopher, or I'm a Mara philosopher, or I am a Toho Laval philosopher, or I am... They will situate the tradition and the space from where they're thinking. They won't say, I'm thinking from a God-eye view, or I am replacing God, I'm thinking from nowhere, or my mind is floating somewhere. And nobody's saying that. And so the West used that same statement, which is a sincere statement, to then say, you see, you're particularistic. Because you are thinking from Buddhism. So I'm sorry, you cannot be the criteria to judge or produce a concept of human rights, or a concept of economy, or a concept of democracy, because you're particularistic. I am not particularistic. I am objective, I'm neutral. I'm not situated anywhere. I'm thinking for the best for everybody. So my knowledge is superior to yours, because I have universality, you don't have universality, you're particularistic. This is the mechanism. Okay? As if Western men would be thinking beyond space or time, or as if it was non-determined by anything. You know, this is the pretension. Okay? And the problem is that this is reproduced on the right and on the left. So in these terms, there's no difference between the two when you look at it from the colonial difference. Okay? So, so you have the pretension here of the critical thinkers of this is that their knowledge, similar to this, is going to be equally applicable to everywhere else in the world. This is the pretension. So, I mentioned yesterday, so this is relevant to social sciences, because today social sciences pretty much are based on the assumption of this Cartesian legacy in which you're supposed to produce an unbiased knowledge. Meaning by that you're supposed to be producing a knowledge that is unsituated, that is, in that sense, beyond any particularism. And so this is the pretension. And anybody who comes and say, well, you know, I'm producing knowledge, someone come and say, as a black woman, my knowledge is da da da, you will be shut down in that conversation. In any discipline of the social science, you're not supposed to talk as a black woman. You see, you're supposed to talk unbiased, objective, neutral, etc.
But the problem is that Western man criteria of knowledge has become the norm, to the point that we don't think of it as a form of particularism. We think of it as a form that is beyond any particularity. So this is where the thing gets, it traps us, because the claim, you know, as I said yesterday, if the philosophy departments in Western universities will call themselves Western male heterosexual philosophy department, I will respect that, you know, because at least they are telling me from where they're thinking from and what is their location in the world from where they're producing knowledge. That's fine, perfectly fine, but that's not the pretension. The pretension is that this is philosophy department, period. Not Western philosophy, not Western male, Western... No, this is philosophy. Anything else is not philosophy, because it doesn't have access to universality. So you cannot teach Buddhist philosophy, you cannot teach Islamic philosophy, you cannot teach indigenous philosophy in a philosophy department. In a Western university, it's not considered philosophy. That's folklore, that's myth, that's culture or whatever. They have all this euphemism to inferiorize the knowledge and not put it at the level of philosophy. Keep it as an inferior type of knowledge. And that's why you go to any department in social science, in philosophy, in humanities, and it's all guys. The Western guys. Western guys. As you read in at the canon of thought. You don't read anybody else. This is Eurocentric fundamentalism at its best. Because you don't read anybody else. You have thought that your knowledge is superior, you know, Western male knowledge, and that's it. There's nothing else to read. It's not necessary to go beyond that. And there are all these mechanisms, institutional mechanisms, to enforce it. Just try to defend a dissertation, okay, in sociology or anthropology, where you are relying in third world thinkers. They will look at you like, what is this? What are you? What kind of dissertation is this? Okay, what is Habermas? Where is you know? They will ask you to bring all these names, you know, because you know you cannot do a dissertation like that. I mean, this is what we're talking about, and you know, there are all these mechanisms to enforce this. That it's not easy to produce a dissertation where you are, in a sense, taking epistemic diversity as your point of departure. It's almost impossible, because Eurocentric fundamentalism will impede that. They will impede that from happening, because institutions enforce this Eurocentric fundamentalism. Now, we never call it fundamentalism, because not even Eurocentric, it's the norm. It has become so ingrained as the norm that we don't even call it a form of fundamentalism. The fundamentals are always the others. Never us, you know, it's always somewhere over there. Okay? And in fact, if you examine carefully, I said the other day that it's the worst form of fundamentalism is the Western one, because it's the one that not only have the institutional, epistemic, material, military, political resources to impose itself around the world, but also because it produced the other forms of fundamentalism. Because if you examine carefully, all the other forms of fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, indigenous fundamentalism, which are a minority in the Islamic world, these are a minority. Okay? It's the same thing with Afrocentric fundamentalists or indigenous fundamentalists. They're a minority. They are variations of Eurocentric fundamentalism. That's why I think this is the most dangerous. Because you watch carefully how the third world fundamentalism, the logic of the argument, is just an inversion of the binaries of a Western fundamentalism. The binary of Western fundamentalism is to say the West is natural and inherently democratic, or natural and inherently for women's rights, or natural and inherently for civil rights, or whatever. For freedom, etc. The non-West is naturally and inherently authoritarian, naturally and inherently patriarchal, naturally and inherently violent, naturally and inherently authoritarian, whatever. So this binary Third world fundamentalists, all they do is just invert it. Accept the binary, the Eurocentric binary, and just invert it. That's why I say Bin Laden is a form of Eurocentric fundamentalism. Because it's an inversion of the binary of the West. Just put it the other way, upside down, and say, yes, democracy and woman liberation, yeah, that's European. And I defend to, you know, oppression of women or an authoritarian regime or whatever. This is an inversion. This is not, first, it's not true, that binary. It's a complete false statement. You know, I went into more detail yesterday about this, about how all these ideas like democracy, human rights, all of this is not a Western thing. This came out from this colonial encounter with many other epistemic traditions, and what the West did was to appropriate all these things and make it as if it was naturally inherently European, and then recycle around the world as it was naturally European. Women's rights, this is just European, the rest are not for human rights. Women's rights, the same, or whatever, democracy. This is false, historically speaking. This is Western historiography has been very successful at trying to bring a narrative that supposedly all these things are European, when in fact they're not. Okay? All these things are coming from different traditions. So these things are not inherently European. That's why the Zapatistas respond with Mandar obedeciendo como el well-being and the Caracoles as a form of democracy. And say, yeah, we have concepts of democracy, we have ways of thinking about democracy that are different from yours. So who told you that you have the monopoly of democratic thinking? You know. So these are things that are, this is a very different response from Bin Laden, you see, because, and that's why I'm saying, Western fundamentalism is the most dangerous, not only because it has the financial military means to impose itself, but it's also because they have, it's the one that produced the binaries, that produced then other forms of Eurocentric thinking, you know, that we call today Islamic fundamentalism, which is an inversion of Western fundamentalism. It's not displacing the binary, it's not questioning the binary, it's just taking it for granted and just putting it like this, upside down, you see? If the West say, I am superior, we have natural inherent in democracy, the others respond, no, I am superior because democracy is a Western thing and we have an authoritarian system that is better than you. So it's just inverting the binary, not displacing it. So this is as Eurocentric as you know, the traditional Western thinkers. So so the point is that the question is now how to escape or how to go beyond this universalism of the West. And here is where I want to introduce a few thinkers that have provided ways of thinking out of this trap. Okay, where always universalism understood one defining for the rest. Okay. First author I want to discuss is Aimé Césaire. Aimé Césaire, you know this author? Have you ever heard of Aimé Césaire? He said, if you haven't heard of Aimé Césaire, with all modesty and humility, I just want to say, you don't know German history. And you don't know European history. You guys are lost. Because this guy had the most thorough analysis of the Holocaust that have been produced by anybody.
He's quite famous in Germany.
Where?
He's quite famous.
He's quite famous, but I'm asking if people know. I see people saying like this. So if he's quite famous, I'm surprised that we are here in Germany. I assume we are in Germany. And that people doesn't know who I'm talking about. You know? Because this is a black guy from the Caribbean, from Martinique. He's the teacher of Fanon, Franz Fanon. He was the teacher of Fanon. His name is Aimé Césaire. His famous text, Discourse on Colonialism, is in English. I don't know if it's in German.
No, it's not in English.
So it's not even in German?
I don't know. I read it.
I don't think it's in German. Okay. We should make a bet. We should make a bet. It's not in German. It's in English. It's in Spanish. I know it's, but I don't think it's in German. I have asked a few people, and people have told me they never heard of him or read him. If you want to understand the Holocaust, you have to read Césaire. He was written, and keep in mind when you read him, that he wrote that in 1950. Okay?
European philosophers and thinkers are still lost trying to figure out the Holocaust. Oh, an exceptionalism to modernity, one group of people would say, no? Other people will trace it back to the Roman Empire and the Paria and things like this, you know, and they will be lost in time, okay? I would recommend to read a Messeser, a black thinker from the Caribbean, who did a reading of the Holocaust in 1950, and today there is a new Holocaust studies coming out, Messeser's insights, that now are pursuing the evidence, the empirical evidence of the thing he said in 1950. And now it's been, many of the things he said in that essay have been proven. Okay? It's been proven. I'm not going to say anymore because I want you to have the curiosity and look for it yourself. Okay? But there is I was bringing Cesare to the conversation because of his definition of universalism. Not because of the Holocaust. The Holocaust, read that essay, Discourse on Colonialism, if you want to understand the Holocaust. And keep in mind that he wrote that in 1950, and keep in mind that there is a new Holocaust studies literature coming out that are now finding the evidence of everything he said in that essay, confirming it. Okay? And he's looking at the Holocaust from the point of view of a black man in the Caribbean, and given that history of Caribbean history, okay? And then looking at the Holocaust and check where he goes with that, okay? Anyway, discourse on colonialism is a response to discourse on method of Descartes. Remember the famous text of Descartes, Discourse on Method, okay? And discourse on colonialism is the response of Cesare to Descartes. And I will say that what discourse on method of Descartes, the I think, therefore I am, and all these things, the dualism, mind, body, all these things, objective knowledge and neutral, what discourse on method of Descartes is for colonial sciences, is discourse on colonialism of Cesare for the future decolonial sciences. Okay, this is a statement that has been made by Nelson Maldonado Torres, a Fanonian philosopher, who has developed this argument. And I'm going to take in my talk now only one point of Cesare, which is his point about universalism. And he says there in another essay, not Discourse on Colonialism, somewhere else, in his letter of resignation to the Communist Party of France in 1956, it's called Letter to Maurice Thorez, because Maurice Thorez was the Secretary General of the French Communist Party, where he says there, I don't want a universalism that, a disembodied universalism. Look at this, a disembodied universalism. I don't want a universalism that erases my particularity and my body. This is a reply to Cartesian and Western universalism. This is a universalism where the body disappears, okay? Where there's no particularity there. You're supposed to be nowhere, okay? So the body should not be there. And you say, I don't want a disembodied universalism. A universalism that disappears my body. I don't want either a particularism that walls me from the rest of the world. I don't want a particularism that walls me from the rest of the world, that segregates me from the rest of the world. I want a universalism that is rich in all particularities. Meaning by that, that the universalism should be an end point, not a point of beginning. What he means by that is that universality cannot be one defining for the rest. Universality has to be the result of a critical horizontal dialogue among multiple epistemic perspectives. In that sense, he's calling for not for a universalism of a different type that I'll be naming here, pluriversalism. Pluriversalism meaning by that, not that one defined for the rest, but that we all in critical dialogues and conversation, horizontally as equal, produce now pluriversal concepts, not universal concepts. Okay. So he's calling for, as opposed to the universalism, this uni is a one. The one that defines all the rest, which is the universalism of the Western main tradition of thought. He's calling for a pluriversalism. Where we develop pluriversal concepts, not universal concepts. And we develop that departing from the acknowledgement of epistemic diversality. And then from there we start the conversation. As equal. Okay? Not one defining for the rest. Okay? Now look at the United Nations. How it works. United Nations works on the principle of this universalism. It's the Western male definition of democracy, human rights, you name it, is what defines the policies of the United Nations. And with that conceptualization, they measure the world. And they go around the world measuring the world and saying, oh, you're part of this, you're not part of this, you're right, etc. So this is the institution of the United Nations is not a pluriversal institution, it's a universal institution. That creates a kind of problem that we're seeing today in the world. Okay? Just to give you an example, but you could see this example ongoing everywhere. Okay? So the other definition that I want to express is Dussel's, Enrique Dussel. So you have Enrique Dussel, Enrique Dussel's concept of transmodernity. Not postmodernity, because postmodernity is a Eurocentric critique to Eurocentrism. Not late modernity. Okay. Because late modernity is still caught within the Eurocentric modernity. Not modernity, because modernity is still caught there, where one defines for the rest. So you have the Eurocentric modernity as a colonial global design. Okay. You have Eurocentric modernity, where you have definitions of human rights, of democracy, of human liberation, of everything, citizenship, civil rights, whatever, defined from within this tradition, and then imposed over the rest of the world by persuasion, by force. Okay? And then you have, how do we escape from that? Well, Dussel said, if you're postmodern, you're going to continue. It's the critical thinkers from within the zone of being. So it's a Eurocentric critique of Eurocentrism. You're not escaping the problem. Okay? You're still caught inside the problem. We don't need to fulfill the incomplete and unfulfilled project of modernity. Because we know what modernity is. Modernity is colonial from the beginning, from 1492, that we discussed that here the first day. Those of you who are not here, the lecture has been recorded if you're interested to listen to them. But I went on and on about why is it that modernity is colonial. There's no modernity without coloniality. You start in 1492, not in the 18th century or 19th century like the post-colonial literature do. Okay? You start in 1492. Modernity is poison from day one with coloniality. There's no modernity without coloniality. Therefore, we don't need more modernity. We know what has produced. We have produced the death project of indigenous people in America, call it the death project. Death of life in all its forms. We don't need, you know, plural modernities. We need something else. And that's what Dussel calls transmodernity. a world beyond modernity. That's the trans. And what does that mean? Okay? For Dussel, that means that if it's true that European modernity has colonized most of the world, all of the world, okay, by the late, from 1492 all the way to the end of the 19th century, all the territories of the world were already under some colonial empire, European colonial empire, no? If it's true that they have subsumed everybody inside the system at the level of the political economy, they have it at the level of subjectivity. What he's claiming is that even though we have been all touched by this process, and there's no pure outside or pure exteriority to this system, that doesn't mean that we are all purely inside the system. Okay? What he's saying is that in different colonial history, you have things like this. Different people around the world have been colonized, in which you have a relative exteriority, one more exterior than other, but it's a relative, not absolute. It's very weird, there's nobody absolute outside it, but it's not, that doesn't mean everybody's absolute inside it. So there are people around the world that have relative exteriority, mean by that is the level of subjectivity and epistemology. There are ways of thinking that were not completely destroyed by European colonization. They are still there. And becomes an important source for producing alternative critical thinking about the problems of humanity today. Just look at the debate about the ecological disaster, and look at the debate between the crisis of the Copenhagen Summit and the response in Cochabamba. The response in Cochabamba was the response of the indigenous people of the Americas to the same issues and problems. They have something to say. And they have concrete proposals. And they have thought about this from a different epistemology from the West. And they have put that forward in the United Nations through the country of Bolivia. You want to know about this? Go to the website, check it out. The concept of when we live, Suma Camaña in Aymara. Badly translated to English into good living, but that had nothing to do with good living the way we think about good living in the West. And they have a whole concept, the Pachamama, which have nothing to do with the concept of nature, because they don't think in terms of nature. Nature is a very Western-centric concept. You think about nature, you have the seeds there of the destruction of nature, of life, because nature is already a Western construct that separates humans from other forms of life, and that has the seeds of its structure. I can go in detail in the discussion. I went in more detail yesterday about this. I just don't want to repeat that. But the point is, look at what Dussel is proposing. Dussel is proposing that from this relative exteriority, you can criticize, you see, this insight. That is, you can criticize Western concept of democracy, Western concept of human rights, Western concept of human liberation, Western concept of all these concepts, Western concept of equality, okay, and come with other ways of thinking about the same from alternative epistemologies, bringing forward, I'm talking about critical thinking, okay? I'm not an epistemic populist. I said that the first day, I repeat it again. I'm not saying that because you are an Indian or a black or whatever, you're going to think critically. The success of the system is always being to make the people from below think like the people from above, okay? So I'm not an epistemic populist. I'm saying the critical thinker from the zone of non-being has producing a knowledge there that redefines the narrative of society modernity in different directions. And this is what he's calling transmodernity. Defining from the extended diversity of the world to construct a world that would be sort of like this. Where now, instead of one defining for the rest, you have multiple definitions of democracy. Okay, multiple institutional frames about the question of democracy, for example. And then have inter-epistemic dialogues that are horizontal to then produce pluriversal concept of democracy that is enriched with all particularities. That is not anymore one particular defining for the rest. What is the universal meaning? But it's now a new form of universal meaning that will be now the result of a critical horizontal dialogue between different traditions of thought. So, this is the project of transmodernity is the project to fulfill the unfinished and incomplete project of decolonization. Okay. And this is the aims of the project of transmodernity, is to, departing from epistemic diversity, then construct a world where all worlds are possible. That is, a world where you can then be able to have, and people could learn from each other. Instead of imposing your ideas on the rest, you could have critical dialogues as equals. And then that way people can say, oh, you know what? What you're doing there is interesting for us. We're learning this and we'll bring that to our form of thinking about democracy or thinking about whatever. Instead of having a world where one defines for the rest and imposes by persuasion, by force, which is the kind of world we have today. And the problem is that the ideas that are produced from that one that defines for the rest are in terminal crisis. And are in terminal crisis, they cannot produce anything new except global nightmares from the right and from the left. And I'm including here 20th century socialism. 20th century socialism was exactly the same problem. It was one defining for the rest, but from the other inside the zone of being, now coming with the global colonial design, and that's the Soviet Empire. Okay? It's a very Eurocentric project, imperial colonial. And of course, they persuade you by ideas, and if they didn't like what you were doing, then they will invade you. Same thing from both sides. Okay? So here, right and left, it just doesn't work. Okay? We're talking about the same methodology, same Eurocentrism, the same imperialism and colonialism there, in the way of behaving and thinking, etc. So what I'm proposing here is a decolonial shift. Okay, it's a decolonial shift to the way we're thinking about many things. And the way to do it is through the concept of a new form of universalism, I'm calling it pluriversalism, and that in the case of Dussel, he would call the political project transmodernity, because it would be transcending the Eurocentric modernity. Now, this is the utopia, no? Now, right now, the power structures of the political economy, the world we live, that I explained yesterday, for those of you who are not here, in my work of decolonizing paradigms of political economy, usually they identify two global structures of power. In my work, I identify around 14 structures of power of the world system we live. And one of them is the epistemic hierarchy, but the point is that until we are able to successfully destroy those power relations and this civilization, we're not going to be able to construct a world that is transmodern. Because right now, the political economy of the system works to have one defining for the rest. And that works militarily, politically, epistemically, racially, gender, sexually, in Christian-centric ways, in all the different structures of power I mentioned yesterday. So, and to end, I want to talk a little about the Zapatistas. The Zapatistas, thinking from Toho Laval cosmology, has a different way of thinking about politics. Because if you watch carefully in the West, left and right, we have secularized Christian narratives. We saw that in the car, we saw that in Hegel, we see that everywhere. And one thing we have done is to secularize Christendom in the way we think about politics. Politics in the West is universal, one that defines for the rest. I have the scientific program, in the case of the left, where I have the correct and truthful ideas, and I go and convince you to get your votes or to get you in my party as a militant. Okay? So that's a form of politics very different from Toho Laval politics, the Zapatistas, where they are talking about politics conceived as walking while asking. Andar preguntando. Which means
you don't have the answers a priori. I, as an indigenous people, I cannot define for you what is best for you. Okay? I know what is best for me, but I don't know what is best for you. So before we establish a political program of struggle, we first start a political dialogue among the oppressed people of Mexico, and then end with a program that will be a pluriverse of meaning, because it will be the result of all the particulars that enter in dialogue, and then you produce a program of the wretched of the earth of Mexico, okay, to struggle against power structure. So the universe of meaning is a pluriverse, and it's produced at the end. It's not at the beginning, because at the beginning nobody can produce that, because that would be against the imperial colonial design. It would be one defining for the rest. So that's what they call a andar preguntando, walking while asking. It says Tojo Laval. That's not even Spanish. That's the Tojo Laval paradoxical way of thinking. But if you watch the West, left and right, we are thinking not from pluriverse of meaning, but from universe, one defining for the rest. So I know what is better for you. So I go and preach you about my truth, and either get your vote or get you as a militant in my party. So that's walking while preaching, which is very Christendom. Because if you think carefully, in Christendom, the Messiah arrived, the Messiah already said the truth, and therefore all we need to do is to follow the Messiah. We, you know, and that Messiah has the truth. He's the Son of God, no? So there's nothing, you know, you follow the truth. So in the West, we're walking while preaching. In the Tojo Laval, they're walking while asking. Because the concept, again, is not universal, one defining for the rest, but pluriversal, is having critical dialogue and producing a pluriverse of meaning that will be the result of the particulars of this horizontal dialogue. This is the project of the other campaign of the Zapatistas. Okay? I'm not going to go in detail about the politics, etc., because they could make mistakes in the politics. We could go into the, you know, the details of that. What I'm trying to rescue here is the epistemic perspective that is behind their campaign, okay, as opposed to the type of politics we do in the West. So I'm giving as example MSSR, Enrique Dussel, and the Zapatistas as people, a group of people who are thinking of a form of universalism that is completely different from the West, because instead of being universal, it's pluriversal. So I will stop here to open for debate.